Football Weekly with James Richardson in association with sportingbet.com.
Football Weekly today, crisis at Man City. Millions spent, but as much chance of getting into Europe as a Eurostar train. Can Il Mancho get them back on track? Plus, in a weekend packed with Big Four kryptonite, United and Liverpool at Fulham and Pompey, visits so costly, John Terry could have guided them. Elsewhere, there's top footwear fondler Sid on Barca's latest cup triumph and more, and Serie A, where Juve are dropping faster than Santa in a greasy chimney. Rotten Egg's racist chance and defeat to the bottom of the table. What more could go wrong? All that plus your post and plenty of good cheer in today's Football Weekly. Hello, everybody, and a special festive mood of pod today. We've draped Jonathan Wilson's tank in fairy lights.
Hello.
Also on board today, Barry Glendenning.
Season's greetings
to you too, Barry, and Paul Doyle.
Hi, James.
Hi to you, Paul.
Fine, thanks.
Hey. Yes, and you look it, and that's great. Now, home for Christmas, like Chris Rea, Mark Hughes. Did he deserve it?
Yes.
Why, Paul? Why?
Well, because he, as you know, he spent almost £250 million and didn't form a coherent team. Granted, they did have a fine victory over Chelsea last week and beat Arsenal's reserves to reach the League Cup semi-final. But much more frequently were disjointed, spiritless, shapeless performances by his team. Now, I'm not saying he might not have got that right and corrected it given more time, but I don't think it's unreasonable to believe that a better manager would need less time to produce a more successful team. And I don't know whether Mancini is that manager. Perhaps you know more about that than me. What would your opinion of him be? And what does Il Mancho mean? I assume that was a reference to him.
Yeah, it's just, you know, Il Mancho is like Mancini, but the manch.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's all right, Rich, I get you.
Bobby Goal, that's another of his. Good a manager.
Sure, that's not Bobby Zamora's nickname.
Oh, well, I think plenty of people have Bobby Goal. Then there was Bobby Goal. That was. I think actually, Mancini, you're right, might have been Bobby Goal.
Tony Cascarino was Tony Goal.
Right. I wonder if you can guess what Ruggiero Rizzitelli's nickname was. Rizzigol. Indeed,
it's
it was.
It's going to be a very long podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I was just going to say that you could bring in the best manager in the world, but in these circumstances, would they not be facing a very, very tough challenge, i.e., a team that doesn't appear to be massively united and picking it up halfway through the season?
Well, I refer you to Roy Hodgson, who picked up a team halfway through the season, didn't have a huge amount of money to spend, and yet just applied his knowledge and expertise to form a coherent side that continues to be successful.
All from a garden shed in Croydon.
One of the reasons why Hughes was given the push at this stage is because the January transfer window is looming.
Right.
And I assume they didn't trust him to invest the money wisely, given some of his previous purchases. Mancini will be allowed to bring in some of his own players, I'm sure. And there are some fine players already there. So, as I say, a very good manager should be able to produce a very good team, particularly when so many of the erstwhile contenders for the top four are slipping off.
Right, you give this move a big thumbs up then, Bordeaux.
I'll reserve my judgment until I see how successful Mancini is, but certainly...
You don't normally reserve your judgment, Mr. Man United out the top four.
Whitney, I'm glad you mentioned that.
Well, we'll see, we'll see. Okay, Jonathan.
I think the one thing you can definitely criticise Hughes for is, I mean, it's an obvious thing to say, that their defence has been awful. That's clearly not to do with the quality of the players. It's to do with organising them. Now, his job is to organise them. And if they're letting in three against Sunderland, three against Bolton, three against Burnley, you know, that's a major problem. I accept there are certain pressures there that aren't there at other clubs. I accept this whole issue of you know, the difficulty of getting a team to gel. But basic defending isn't happening, and Hughes ultimately has to take responsibility for that.
And while he may have paid over the odds for some of the defenders he's brought in, they are all good defenders. Like, we have seen them defend well in the past, and they're comically inept at the moment, like really poor.
And I think the worrying thing as well is, you know, Shay Given's actually had a quite good season. How bad would it be if he were chucking him in as well?
Yeah.
Well, was it someone in this pod, or was it some perhaps a pub chat I had with friends? I can't remember which, but someone...
Frankly, I'm hurt by that.
Well, in your case, it could have been,
I could have been
talking to you in the pub and we can't remember.
Mm. Are you by the suggestion that you're a friend of Barry?
But someone was positing the theory that Shea Given perhaps might not be the best defender in the world, or goalkeeper in the world, because he's played behind too many really awful defences to be, you know, for it to be a coincidence.
Mm. Well, I think it is true that part of a goalkeeper's job is to organise a defence, and given how shambolic both Newcastle and Manchester City have been, there'd be a suggestion that he's not really doing that. But yeah, that notwithstanding, his shot stopping has still been excellent this season.
Yeah, indeed. Mancini, looking at his track record, and he's a man who's always loved English football to the extent that, you know, he came back out of retirement to go and play at Leicester, almost moved to Arsenal when David Platt went there from Sampdoria. It's a tough one, this, because, as I said, it's very difficult circumstances coming in on.
But I don't see how it can be very difficult, because he's got a team that are quite well placed in the league. Not as well placed as their owners think they should be, but they're still okay. You know, they're not in danger of relegation or anything. He's got presumably pots and pots of money to spend. So how is that a bad situation? It's a great situation.
Because he doesn't have any time to work with the team, to familiarise himself with the team, or indeed this new league, which for all him playing at Leicester, he's not especially familiar with the ins and outs of. And he's immediately got Stoke may not
but
be
have
the
you
toughest
not said in the past that he's a very keen student of the English game?
No, he is.
That he's, so but he's probably pretty much on top of it.
And his son once had a trial at Man City, so he must know all about their setup as well.
That was last week, wasn't it?
No, it was a year ago.
All right.
Mancini, the difficulty is that he has done very well in the past and he's also done less impressively. And the worrying thing from Man City's point of view is that, in my opinion, he did much better in very different circumstances. When he was at clubs with no money at all, like Fiorentina and Lazio, he did really well. Fiorentina, that was the year they were going bankrupt, and he took them to an Italian Cup win. Lazio, similar story. They were so poor they couldn't pay their players for 6 months, and they got up to the top of towards the top of the table, won the Italian Cup, got into Europe, etc. And everyone thought, well, this is remarkable. He's a really charismatic leader. When he went to Inter, where he had a locker room full of players with slightly prickly personalities, bet you're wondering what I was going to say there, and loads of money to spend, things didn't go as well. And I say that despite the fact that he won three titles in a row, but we all know that one of them was given to him by default because of Calciopoli. One was almost handed to him by default because there was no competition. And the third one, he just had a much better squad than everybody else. I don't think anybody watched Inter in those years and thought, this is a really fine and well-organised football team. And that's precisely why they struggled so much in Europe. And I think the fact that even though he won three titles, he was still available a year and a half after leaving Inter in slightly strange circumstances. He had a post-game rant about how he was going to be fired, and his nerves seemed to be fraying, rather. All this time afterwards, nobody else has come in for him.
Sounds a bit like Mark Hughes' record there. Did well with very modest clubs not so well with richly endowed.
Well, it's interesting you make the point about Roy Hodgson, because would his method, which requires a lot of self-sacrifice on the part of players, a lot of hard work, you know, in terms of getting the shape right, and I imagine quite a lot of boring work on the training field, how transferable is that to a top level? Because his record at Inter wasn't great, was it?
The first time he was there, when he had a proper full season, he was all right. But Inter in those days had one or two kind of endemic problems. Inter fans would say one of them was the fact that Juve were rigging the league so that Inter couldn't win it. The kind of merits or not of that theory aside, there were also all sorts of problems within the structure of the club. Too many chiefs, not enough Indians in terms of player acquisitions, etc. And there was the famous sale of Roberto Carlos that left the team without a proper left back for they're still kind of continuing the search. And that was always pinned on Hodgson, but he's always vehemently denied that. But they did reasonably in his first time. And the second time he went there, he was, I think, the fourth manager they'd had in a season, and he was basically just coming in as a favour to see them to the end of the campaign.
How much of this sort of change in personnel do you think is down to the shortcomings of the big four sides as opposed to Hughes's shortcomings, in that Hughes has claimed that, you know, he was on course for the top six finish his owners required, but now that it, you know, with so many other Chelsea, Man U, Arsenal, Liverpool all losing games left, right and centre, that they think, oh, well, hold on a second, we could win this league.
Yeah. Well, that's the point I think Paul was hinting at before, no? That the weakness of the so-called Big Four has only increased the owner's desire to seize this opportunity.
Yeah, and in fact, if you don't like the Roy Hodgson comparison, we could compare his record at City to Sven's.
Well, I was going to say, why not bring Sven back? He had a terrific time there with many of the same players.
Yeah, I mean, it got bad towards the end. I recall an 8-1 defeat at Middlesbrough.
But the first half of the season was great, so you just bring him in.
He imposed a method. It didn't succeed in every match by any means, but Hughes didn't have a method, certainly not one that the players universally adhered to anyway.
I wonder if Sven's sitting there a little bit miffed, actually, that he didn't get a call, and his former protégé, Mancini, did. Mancini, of course, learned his coaching trade at the knee of Sven-Göran Eriksson, almost literally. Some posts, PF10 says he thinks Mancini won't handle the big ogres like Robinho, Adebayor, Bellamy, etc. He'll probably win the first few games. Sooner or later, he'll lose the dressing room just like he did at Inter. Formica Tomica disagrees, says the foreigners will love him. Ibrahimovic was happy with Mancini when he was at Inter. There was respect for him in Manchester because he was a magical player. Mark Hughes, on the other hand, is not really known outside these islands. Why would Robinho want to play for someone who was too lumpy to hack it in a simple five-a-side game in Barcelona? Interesting point. Mowgli84 wonders whether Mark Hughes in time will prove the Claudio Ranieri figure for City, i.e. building the foundations of a successful team for some other flesh so-and-so to come in and then reap the rewards from. Syed Netting says they'll win nothing with Kidd. Brian Kidd, of course. Very nice there. Well, Mark Hughes now then at home or off to Dubai or wherever he's heading to spend his $3 million payoff. What's the future for him?
It's funny, we were discussing earlier, you know, the QPR job would have been ideal for him, you know, sort of a club with money and up and coming.
Well, he's just got time for a 2-week holiday then.
So he'd probably get his holiday in Dubai and then he could come back and manage QPR when Paul Hart gets sacked.
Right. How unfortunate. Good. Now, another Italian manager anyway makes his way to the Premier League. The other two, West Ham's Gianfranco Zola and Chelsea's Carlo Ancelotti, of course, met on Sunday. A big point this for the Hammers in the 1-1 draw. And they were playing quite well, by all accounts.
Yeah, it was a weird game. I thought, just from doing the minute-by-minute, that Chelsea completely overran them in the first half and somehow managed to go in a goal down. And yet, the Chelsea players and Ancelotti said after the game that they'd played as badly as they have all season in the first half. Which their finishing was poor, but I thought their general play was good. And
no, I'm right with you there. I was really baffled by those post-match things.
I'm going to leave now and never come into a podcast because I've made an erudite comment with which Giles and Wilson agrees.
Okay, Frank Lampard was saying that it was their worst first half of the season, but I thought they were a bit unlucky to go in 1-0 down.
They were astonishingly unlucky.
Does that say something about the respective level of the two clubs, if they play their worst game of the season and still are unlucky to go in?
Well, because I think West Ham deserved a draw over the whole game. I mean, the other strange thing about the game was that there were two penalties in it. Now, I think there were six shouts for penalties in that game, of which the referee, Mike Dean, got one right. I think Chelsea had three penalties they should have had that weren't given. And I think the one they were given was wrong. I think the one West Ham got was right. And I think West Ham should have had another one.
Yeah.
Right.
On the subject of that penalty, which had to be taken three times because the first two times Chelsea players encroached.
Mm-hmm.
Why should they be allowed to take it again? I know the rules state that they should be allowed, but change the rules. If you encroach at a penalty, just like if you commit a foul throw, It's a free kick out. You've
West
botched
Ham
your opportunity.
Also encroached.
Well, you can't punish Chelsea for the encroachment.
What is my phone?
Ah, what a pro! I thought Frank Lampard did very well to keep his head, because it probably took 5 or 6 minutes to eventually get the ball into the net for it to count, and he scored all three on all three attempts. Put the ball in a different place in each of the three attempts. I'm not quite sure what Mike Dean, the referee, was playing at. It seemed he had decided if there was a penalty, he was going to, you know, make a stand and cut out this encroaching. I also think some of the players don't appear to have known the rules. This is, you know, players in not knowing rules of the game shock. But that if you encroach on the D around the edge of the square, that's also encroaching.
Well, really?
The D is there.
Really?
That's why. That's the whole point of the D.
I often wonder what the D was there for.
Yeah, 10 yards from penalty.
Stop you.
But Mike Dean is Mr. Penalty. He's given 23 in 2009, just 10 more than any other referee.
You
should have seen the way his fairy lights twazzled and dizzled as he said that. There's some ticker tape spewing out the side.
Has Mike Dean, but have they been all legit, or the majority have been legit?
I don't know. I think he's quite a poor ref generally, but...
All right. But on a far more interesting note, what about John Terry?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know. We've had Terry's mum, Terry's dad. So far, nothing on the chocolate orange, but it's only a matter of time. What's with this family?
I think it's unfair publishing those details of Terry's parents, to be honest.
Right.
It's not his fault. You know, you can't blame a child for the sins of their parents.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, yeah. And, all right. Well, what about
some would say that if as those stories would suggest, he came from a troubled background, he did very well to forge
absolutely
a good career for himself.
And every time a scandal like this breaks, he seems to play with exemplary calm and composure.
Yeah. I'm not sure how scandalous this latest thing
is. Well, tell us about it. If there are anyone who, say, abroad didn't manage to pick up the
Sunday... Well, I didn't
Sunday.
Pick it up. Barry was telling me this morning. Barry has read it.
Well, he was the subject of a sting in the News of the World tabloid newspaper on Sunday, not for the first time, but some undercover reporters were brought to the Chelsea training ground by a well-known ticket tout called Tony Bruce.
Who's a mate of Terry's.
Who's a mate of John Terry's and has been since Terry was a boy.
Right.
And they basically arranged a deal where Terry was going to have lunch with them, show them around the training facilities, show them the jacuzzi where Michael Essien or Didier Drogba and Michael Ballack were relaxing in their pants. And that's not an image you want to think about.
I don't
really
want people wearing pants.
But so $10,000 in cash is alleged to have changed hands, two of which was going to the agent or the Tony Bruce, and eight of which was to be, Terry insisted, given to a charity, the Make-A-Wish Foundation or something.
Right.
So there's no suggestion that he took the money himself or had any intention of keeping the money. I think it's kind of grubby that, you know, a player is showing people around the training ground their club, and I'm surprised that...
On the sly. He's quite clear, I think, in the video, in the fact that he's not supposed to be doing this.
Yeah, well, that... He reckoned that if the hierarchy at the club found out about it, his exact words were, you know, it's classic Cockney, it's a little bit, so
But if he's doing it for the kids, Barry, for charity.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's no suggestion he was going to trouser the money himself.
No.
I don't think he's the worst fella in the world, but he just does a lot of stupid things.
Well, don't we all?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's it for part one. That little moment of truth rounds out part one of our Premier League discussion, but there's more. We're going to have a quick word on Fulham, on Birmingham, who Chelsea face next, on Man United, and of course Portsmouth and Liverpool. Paul Doyle was at the game. We'll have his thoughts after this.
Football Weekly from The Guardian, in association with SportingBet.com.
Right, now, one of the big shocks of the weekend, Man United's 3-0 defeat at Craven Cottage by Fulham. The miraculous Fulham. Roy Hodgson, a genius. How's he done it, Jonathan Wilson?
By playing a very simple 4-4-2 that he's always played. He came through Alan Wade's coaching course in the late 60s. Alan Wade was a technical director of the FA, and he was really kind of central in setting up kind of an English style that people like Bobby Houghton came through, like Don Howe. Quite a functional way of playing, but you see the same principles Hodgson applied all through his time in Sweden. Still applies them with Fulham. They close down the space very well. They maintain their shape very well. There's obviously a lot of work as in the training field in terms of keeping the shape, in terms of... how you manipulate the space. I mean, I saw Sunderland play there, three weeks ago, is it now? And Sunderland lost 1-0, but they were well beaten 1-0. And for about 20 minutes, I was raging at how bad Sunderland were. And then I kind of realised, actually, it's because they're just not being given any space at all. Fulham are a very, very well-drilled machine. And that's why I raised the point before about, could Hodgson do that with slightly more prima donna-ish players, who may be more skillful than what he's got now, but possibly would be less willing to submit themselves to this kind of quite dogmatic approach. And
being,
I think it was a problem that Erigo Sacchi had, for instance, in the later years at Milan. One of the reasons it went wrong there was that the people like Hullet and Van Basten got sick of this incredibly boring work they do in the training pitch. But I think that the reason they beat Man United, I think there's a very obvious mitigating factor for United, which is they got seven defenders out. So they went to this back three as a bit of a kind of emergency measure, and it didn't really work because none of the three particularly good headers of the ball, and so all Fulham did was knock it in high to Zamora, who's in great form at the minute, and Zoltan Gyökeres, who's playing really well coming
off
the flank.
So it's not too mitigating a factor, because Fulham were without some of their first choice forwards as well.
That's
as a result, they had to play Zoltan Gyökeres up there. One other thing to come out of that Manchester United Fulham game, hopefully, was the end to the Michael Owen for England campaign. His performance was laughable. There was one shot in particular which literally made me laugh. It was so bad, and I know he scored a hat-trick in the Champions League in a relatively meaningless game against Wolfsburg the other week, but this season he has been pretty poor, as expected. He's got 4 shots on target in 14 games, and I don't think that's enough to impress Fabio Capello.
Mm. Hats off to Portsmouth. Beating Liverpool. Paul Doyle, you were there. 1-0 to the Arsenal post in saying, has someone made the joke of Liverpool having hit a nadir?
Yeah.
Yeah, they have. Okay. All right.
Nadir Belhadj, as well as scoring a goal, actually, it's worth highlighting his role, because he hadn't started a league game under Avram Grant until Saturday. Mm-hmm. And Grant, showing some tactical acumen, brought him in specifically to stop Glenn Johnson from raiding forward.
Yeah.
And thereby nullified most of Liverpool's attacking threat. But I went there actually, and my intention was to write an article explaining how or whether Avram Grant has changed things at Portsmouth since his arrival there, because there's been so many Liverpool blogs and articles recently, I just found it boring. But Liverpool were so bad that I felt obliged to write about them. Well, it was the worst performance from Liverpool I can remember, to be honest.
Right.
And as well as, you know, the limitations of Dessain and Cout and all these jokers, what shocked me was the lack of spirit, because under Rafa, their most celebrated victories have tended to be against the odds when they've rebelled and just through sheer energy and anger, they've overcome a seemingly futile situation. But there was none of that there. The players on the ball had so little support when they went forward, because Liverpool just looked resigned.
It's curious. Last year, the limitations of the squad were supposed to be the major thing that was hampering Benitez. The fact that there was only one Gerrard, there was only one player available for the Torres role, one decent player available for that role. And so when they got injuries, that's where the wheels kind of came off their title challenge. This year, though, they're piling up disastrous results, even with Gerrard and Torres in the side.
Because, I mean, there was no way that people like Cout were going to sustain their good form of last season. I mean, they hit a good streak last year, and it nearly took them to the title, but it was never sustainable.
Stan Collymore has been saying on his radio show that, according to his sources, who you'd presume were probably pretty good at Liverpool, that Steven Gerrard and Fernando Torres have lost all faith in the manager. Now, say what you like about Collymore, some people think he's a clown. I happen to think he's a very good pundit myself, and that he often gets criticism for stuff that has nothing to do with his punditry skills. But, there's probably more than a grain of truth to that.
The performance on Saturday would have backed that up. I think it's Gerrard and Carragher he has identified as having lost confidence rather than Gerrard and Torres.
Is Torres fully fit?
Well, he hasn't had the hernia operation that apparently would cure his problem on a long-term basis. Mm. But
it's interesting that with those boots, they're not able to... Sorry.
Yeah. No, but that's it. Torres is interesting because during his protracted disputes and propaganda campaign at Anfield, Rafa has continually suggested that the reason why he hasn't challenged Manchester United and Chelsea in particular is because he hasn't been able to pay the sort of transfer fees that they have over the years. And when he splashed out on Torres, and Torres proved to be such a brilliant success, it backed up the suggestion that had he got similar resources, he would be able to achieve similar results. However, Torres is almost an exception at this stage. When you look at 20 million, Robbie Keane was a flop. Johnson isn't looking too hot. Aquilani, we don't know.
So the
question is, if Liverpool's owners do find some money from somewhere or whatever, would you entrust it to Rafa Benitez?
Do you think Rafa Benitez at this point, I mean, we saw this bizarre post-game interview.
That was cringe-inducing.
He gave. Do you think he'd almost rather be fired? Because we know that nobody can afford to fire him, so he's almost trapped in the job. Things are getting worse and worse. Do you think there's a part of him that's just like, oh, put me out of my misery?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if nobody can afford to fire him. I know he's just signed a new 5-year contract in March, but the way things are now, that there are provisions in these contracts that you don't have to pay the full 5 years if you sack him. There is a set fee. So I don't know how much that fee is. But you could also ask, can they afford to keep him? Because it doesn't look like they're going to get into the Champions League next year.
Right. Can I just ask, Paul, you were saying that you actually went there to write a piece about whether Avram Grant's actually changed anything, because the results have certainly improved. What has he done, do you think? Is it him, or is it just things finally gelling together after?
Yeah, well, they were playing quite well under Paul Hart, but they were continually undone either by bad finishing and defensive errors. And the most noticeable thing since Grant has come is that they haven't been making any errors. They're also a little bit similar to Roy Hodgson. They've become a very compact unit in terms of the way that they deny space to opponents, and that's just about working on the shape of the team. And he's done that well. He's also rotated his squad in quite well in the short amount of time he's been there. He's picked players to do specific jobs against specific opponents, Bel Hadj being a prime example. And they've performed. They've got 7 points from their five league games since he's been there, including points off top half teams, which they didn't do under Paul Hart.
Right.
And yeah, it's looking pretty good. The transfer embargo in January and the African Nations Cup is going to hit them hard.
Oh, yeah. Begovic, fantastic save from him. They move past Jermaine Defoe in the scoring charts now, Portsmouth, so that's nice. But they're still rock bottom. But anyway, well done to Portsmouth. In other Premier League news...
Do just women count in Jermaine Defoe's scoring chart? Because I'd say he's still edging it if they are.
Now then, in other Premier League news... Liverpool have Wolves next. And the obligatory joke is that Wolves may just use their first team for that encounter. Arsenal, meantime, beat Hull. They're now 2 points behind United with the game in hand. How far are they behind Chelsea?
They are 6 points behind Chelsea.
With a game in hand over Chelsea?
Yes.
All right, then. Spurs won at Blackburn. And Barry, their Christmas party, Copper-faced Jacks. Is that right?
Yes.
In Dublin.
It's a legendary Dublin night spot. It was described as a trendy Dublin night spot in the Fiver on Friday, which shows I wasn't in on Friday because I'd assume set everyone straight on that one. Have you ever been there, Paul?
I have, actually,
it's,
yes.
It's a disco dancing emporium on Harcourt Street in Dublin, and it's basically about 5,000 people in there every night.
Why would they have chosen that place, then?
Well, it's a notorious meat market, and it's full of patronised by off-duty Gardaí, nurses and students. And basically, if you go to Copperface Jacks on the pull and don't, you might as well just throw your hat at it because you're never going to pull.
Right.
But I'm not suggesting that's why. They were originally supposed to be going on a golf outing.
Very interesting, very interesting. But anyway, they won at Blackburn on the weekend, so it doesn't seem to have done them too much harm.
Villa? It was actually the week before they lost to Wolves that they went on this jolly. But,
two or 3 days before, but
yeah, they were back 72 hours before the kickoffs. Right. I don't think that makes any difference.
No?
Nah.
Why do teams have training programs, do you think?
Well, you hear this stuff like, oh, you shouldn't be drinking. You know, if you have a few pints 3 days before a game, what the hell difference
is it? In another city, in another country.
Well, I mean, I can only speak firsthand. The Offaly hurling team used to have a famous midfielder who I know quite well from my hometown, Johnny Pilkington, who always used to, the night before an All-Ireland final, which is the biggest game you'll ever play in hurling, he used to be in the bar the night before having a few pints, and not on the tear, but just having 4 or 5 pints, because he said, if I break my routine, it'll affect my game tomorrow, so why should I break my routine?
Well, yes, indeed. There's a fascinating story, Barry, and I'm sure you put a lot of Spurs minds at rest there. Villa,
do you think having a few pints 3-4 days before a game is going to affect your performance?
Four?
If you go out in the lash, right, you're going to be a mess the day after.
Yes.
And you might not be great the day after that.
Yeah.
But then you'll be fine.
I'm not a sports scientist, but I'm willing to see a correlation between flying to another country, probably being...
It's only an hour on the plane. It wasn't exactly long haul.
You still have to fly. That has a physical impact. Disruption to your schedules, etc. You get there, you spend the entire night probably out on the lash, put all sorts of poisons into your body, enjoyable poisons, but poisons nonetheless, toxic substances, and then the next day feel like, well, as you do, doing hurling of a strictly non-Ireland variety, and then you fly back again, and then you've probably got 2 days of training, one of which you're not very or in shape for. I think that could have an impact.
Are you not surprised that Harry fell for this story in the first place? Oh, we can't have a Christmas party, but let's go and play golf together in
he
Ireland.
He probably knew what was going on and he's quite happy to, A, have them have their party, and then, B, play the big bad boss, and then they'll all be united in their punishment. And it's all part of the tradition of it, I don't know. Is it? I don't know. Anyway, Villa are unbeaten in 11 now. Well done to Aston Villa. And Wolves, of course, won their game with Burnley. That is more than enough on the Premier League. And so very, very shortly, we're going to be hearing from Sid Lowe in the snowbound Madrid. Exciting, this. Sid joins us on the line from a snowbound Madrid.
Yeah, the whole country, not just Madrid. Spain is under lots and lots of snow. All of the games managed to take place.
Right.
Last night and Saturday night, so we did have a full programme before Christmas, because of course the difference between Spain and England is there's now Christmas breaks. This feels like a watershed in a way that it really doesn't in England.
Right, okay, and the watershed comes with Real and Barcelona miles ahead of the rest. Of course, Barcelona miles away over the last weekend, because they were off in Abu Dhabi for the World Clubs Cup, which they won. Six titles in a year, and what titles? They've got to be one of the greatest club sides ever to grace the game.
Well, if you're going to take it as an individual season, I think they are the greatest club side there's ever been. If you're going to take it as an individual season, of course, then you can argue about how much you enjoyed watching them and so on and so forth. But I think it is very, very striking. They've won all of these tournaments in really brilliant style as well, the way they've played. Now I know obviously there's always the fly in the ointment, which is the Chelsea semi-final in the Champions League, but otherwise I just think Barcelona's superiority this year has been almost entirely uncontestable, and this weekend they won 2-1, and yes, it took an 89th minute equalizer to take it into extra time, but they completely dominated the game. The goal that Estudiantes scored looks suspiciously like it might be offside, and they played wonderful football all the way through it. Again, you know, you've got all those arguments which are difficult, because it's almost too easy for Barcelona to be smug, and it's too easy for them to act like they're different to everyone else and they're wonderful, and isn't that embodied by having UNICEF on their shirt instead of a multinational and all the rest of it. But it is true that Barcelona, you know, this weekend, for example, I think it was 7 youth team products in their starting 11. Leo Messi's the best player in the world, created by Barcelona, albeit bought in from Argentina as a 12-year-old. So almost everywhere you look, this seems perfect, and it seems almost too perfect. Guardiola is this weekend broke into tears for the first time. We've seen that kind of face of serenity kind of crack in front of us. But it's a really genuinely extraordinary achievement. And I know that obviously I get accused of trying to make a point to defend something I wrote a year or so ago, but I'm going to make it anyway. Dani Alves, who I once said was the second best player in the world. Now, I know that will have been a step too far, but Dani Alves has now played in his career 11 finals. He's won them all. It's not coincidence.
Sid. Meantime, back at the ranch, Real Madrid beat Zaragoza 6-0. Cristiano Ronaldo getting his 13th goal in 12. That's pretty good. And another two for Higuain.
Yeah, it's amazing, really. I mean, I know, obviously, everybody knows this because they've seen him play a lot, but watching Cristiano Ronaldo this year, I mean, he really is very, very, very good. Mm. He's an extraordinary athlete. Every time he ran at Zaragoza, they look petrified. And this game's very significant, and it's very significant for one simple reason, and this is the thing I've been writing my column about this morning, that Real Madrid have been winning this season an awful lot. They went into week 12 off the table, statistically their best ever start of the season. But there's a difference, and it's a set phrase, almost a cliche that gets used in Spanish. There's a difference between winning and convincing, or convencer y vencer, are not the same thing in Spanish. And Barcelona have been playing well and convincing and winning. Madrid winning, but not convincing anyone. And now they're starting to convince as well. There's something much more natural about the way they play now, much more logical about the way they set it up. And you go back to maybe the Alcorcon game as a turning point, or perhaps the Barcelona game as a turning point. And they look like a genuinely good side now. It's difficult to judge properly, because this weekend they battered a Zaragoza team who are absolutely awful. Really genuinely rubbish. It's not that they didn't defend well, it's that they didn't defend at all. They were an appallingly bad side. But Madrid made them look very, very bad, or even worse than they probably are, and did look extremely impressive themselves. And Higuain is the man, more than anyone else, I think, who probably deserves the credit for Real Madrid.
Brilliant. Well, Sid, listen, may I wish you on behalf of the pod and all our listeners a Feliz Navidad and a Feliz Año Nuevo. And I look forward to speaking to you in 2010.
Thank you very much. Have a great Christmas and New Year to everyone there as well.
And you too, Sid.
Ooh, Barcelona have drawn Stuttgart in the Champions League. Real got Lyon. Arsenal, Porto. This is all last Friday, of course, after our last. Yeah, all sorts of excitement about that. Porto, are they going to cause more trouble than they did last time for Arsenal, do you think, Jonathan?
Well, they caused United quite a lot of trouble last year, didn't they? Having not been particularly impressive in the groups. I think Hulk is a decent and awkward centre-forward. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've lost a couple of players. Well, I mean, they've lost Sissoko and they've lost...
Lisandro Lopez.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things you have to say about Porto that they're very good at is continually developing, and I guess possibly the case is that they get better as the season goes on. As a result of that, they're constantly selling players on, bringing players in. But yeah, I think there's certainly the potential for them to cause Arsenal bother, but I would have thought Arsenal would have enough.
Right, okay. The other big draws for the English team, of course, Chelsea have got Inter, Mourinho going back there, we all know about that, Beckham back at Manchester United because they've drawn Milan. Europa League, and one of the impressive things, I think, I was eavesdropping on you, were you saying this, Paul, this morning, that Fulham getting into the Europa League, I remember at the end of last season, everyone said, oh, that's a curse, it's a poison chalice because it'll wreck their league campaign, but not a bit of it. They're doing well in the league and doing well. There they are through to the next round. They're going to meet the holders, Shakhtar Donetsk. Excitingly, the winners will meet the winners of the game between Juve and Ajax, which is a very, very interesting game. We'll talk more about Juve in a second.
I've kind of revised my opinion on the Europa League, actually. I did think it was a complete waste of time, but I think when you see a team like Fulham doing well, and their generation of their fans have no experience of travelling away for games like that, it's good.
Yeah, but I think it also is a very useful competition for teams like Shakhtar, that they're at the moment not quite good enough to compete in the Champions League, which possibly might be part of the calendars I think I've discussed before, but it gives them something to play for in the spring. It gives them European experience, so you get that kind of second band of clubs from say the English League or the Italian League or the Spanish League, plus the top teams from kind of a second band of countries,
right,
like Ukraine, like Russia, like I guess Germany look very strong in the Europa League as well this year.
I do think, though, that the winners should get a Champions League place.
Yeah, go on then. Liverpool was another team who have a little something for.
Had one and lost it anyway, didn't they? So
Liverpool will be facing Unirea.
Unirea's collapse against Stuttgart, pathetic as it was, I think, it should be said, they were missing two centre-backs and a holding midfielder from that game, so I think it's understandable they had some defensive issues in the first quarter of an hour.
Point made, Jonathan. Nice.
By the way, I emailed Mr. Jonathan Wilson last Thursday and said that I'd noticed Everton were putting out a team of 12-year-olds against, who was it?
Bate Borisov.
Yeah, Bate Borisov. And Borisov were 4-1. So I said, should I back them? Wilson said no.
Yep.
But luckily I ignored him.
Ah, excellent. Now, I'm just going to whiz through some posts. Philip Neeson, Schemey, V. Sinica, all very interesting. Your comments on the Wolves reserve story. Unfortunately, don't have time to go into them now. ZoomTube brings up the interesting case. He says, forget Portsmouth for a second and spare a thought for fans of lowly Ankaraspor in Turkey, whose record so far this season reads, played 15, lost 15, goals scored none, goals against 45. Which sounds remarkable. Insane Teacher comes up with the explanation. There's been a lot of hoo-ha in Ankara over ownership of two of the city's teams. There's Ankara Gusu, I probably pronounced that wrong, that's the home, of course, of the, well, homeless Darius Vassell, and that's owned by the son of the city's mayor. And then there's Ankaraspor, who are owned by the city's mayor. And because he was apparently going to merge the two but still had them playing in the same competition, Turkish authorities stepped in and said, no, you will. They relegated Ankaraspor from the from the division, and every week their game is awarded 3-0 to the opposition.
Oh, everyone should Google Darius Vassell's blog, actually.
Who? What?
Darius Vassell is keeping a blog from his hotel room.
All right.
And he's really having a very, very miserable time of it in Turkey. So I think if everyone should log on and read it anyway, and maybe send him a Christmas message of support. He's very miserable. I'd say he'd love to come home.
Ars Technica says, Southgate must be having a laugh. Borough are 20 points from the top spot now in the Championship. Could Strachan drive them towards relegation at this rate? Yes or no?
I don't know, to be honest. I haven't really been following their progress.
All right,
probably not. But weren't you in favour of Southgate sacking at the time?
Me?
Mm-hmm.
No. Was I? I can't remember.
I still remember we had
it's more
the
than 30
time.
Seconds ago. Did we have a chat? Did we have a
we did, yeah.
an argument?
On this thing?
No, I think what happened was you were saying he needed more time, and I said, surely, Jonathan, he's been given unbelievable quantities of time. Having said that, if I was going to sack him, I would have done it during the summer. Or
which I believe was my point, wasn't it? Anyway, that's...
In which case, you were right, Jonathan.
Yeah, thanks, that's all I wanted to hear.
Yeah. That's what I was saying about Hughes and Mancini earlier on. Just
just because Middlesbrough aren't doing well doesn't mean they were wrong to sack Southgate. It might mean they were wrong to appoint Gordon Strachan.
Right.
But so it's a two-step process, and you have to get both steps right.
Chris Hughton, in the meantime, has Newcastle, what is it, 7 points clear or something, at the top of the Championship? Something big like that, after their 2-0 win over Borough. Also in Championship news, Watford avoided the threat of administration. We're all excited about that. Lord Ashcroft came in with a £4.88 million. And Barry, you're excited about Charlton's 4-4 draw with Millwall in League One.
I wasn't excited about it, but I think it's worth mentioning.
All right.
Because I'm sure we'll be pilloried if we don't. But yeah, it was a very exciting game. I was talking to producer Pete before we came into the pod. He's a Charlton fan. He's very, very upset that they sort of didn't win it. And I don't think there was any trouble. He was saying there was some Millwall fans in the home section, but they got turfed out of the stadium.
Well, hold on, there was never going to be trouble at that. Well, if there had been trouble at that match, it would have been a sad indictment on humanity, because the match was the whole theme of the match was it was part of a campaign to end street violence, and parents of two teenagers who've been stabbed or beaten to death recently were on hand to promote peace and happiness throughout urban Britain. So if that had degenerated into violence, it would have been very depressing.
Not hugely surprising.
Right. I tell you what, violence off the streets and that, afraid that things aren't looking too good in Turin as we move swiftly and finally indeed on to a quick nod to Serie A. Lots to talk about this week. Roma keeping their third clean sheet in a row, beating Parma, who we bigged up last week. Napoli moving steadily up the table. Inter extending their lead at the top, but it's really all about Juventus. Every week it gets worse, Barry. We had stones thrown at their team bus on the way to the game this weekend. Racist chants during the game against bottom of the table Catania. And indeed a defeat to bottom of the table Catania, 2-1. It's the first time since 1963 that the Sicilians have been able to come away from Turin with all 3 points. And the fans were so angry that not only did they turn their backs literally on the team during the game, but afterwards they barracked them in the dressing room. It was it's become...
Barracked or barricaded?
Did I mean barricaded? Yeah, apparently I meant barricaded. Barricaded them in.
Well, I don't know. I'm asking.
I don't know what barracking would be.
Could be shouting abuse at them.
Well, I think there was some of that as well.
But what will there be any official reaction to the racist chanting?
Well, yes, they may well get another stadium ban. There is a strong suggestion that apart from the fact that some of Juve's fans are plainly imbeciles, that the reason they were doing this and throwing firecrackers and homemade fireworks, etc., onto the pitch was because they want to attack they want to cause problems for the directors of Juventus, who they're basically causing trouble for the club, and it's their way of generally making life uncomfortable because they want changes to them to be made. They want basically everybody fired. And there have been moves by Juventus to contact top managers. Gus Hiddink apparently has been contacted. But officially, they're still backing Ferrara, who himself says, despite 5 defeats in their last 6 games, well, we're a ship in a storm, but I'm not going to abandon the bridge. But this really is a new nadir, to borrow the expression. It does seem to get worse week by week. And the other thing about this, and everyone in Italy has been pointing up the fact that Claudio Ranieri, the man they axed 2 games before the end of last season, and that's a lot of people are pointing to that as the hugest mistake by the Juve, the people who run Juve, that Ranieri has taken Roma from their disastrous start to just 2 points behind Juve now, and he was making all sorts of comments saying, oh, if it had been me, I would have been fired by this point by Juventus, given their current woes. They really are woeful right now, Juventus, and Italy too are off on a winter's break, so it'll be interesting to see what happens to an extent. The fact that Marcello Lippi is due to join them as their kind of technical director after the summer's World Cup, that kind of blocks a lot of the changes that they might otherwise make. But it really is impossible to see how a team that started the season well and has just got worse and worse, as I say, week by week, can continue with dear old Ciro Ferraro, who's a lovely bloke, but doesn't seem in any way able to cop it as a manager. And his team seem to be absolutely petrified at the moment. Yeah, good. All right, then. Now, producer Ben says that's enough Football Weekly for now. I have to say, we won't be back on Thursday because it's Christmas Eve and that, and we'll be off buying satsumas and spinning tops for, the cherished people in our lives. Yeah. And so have a very happy Christmas from everyone here at the pod. We will be back on the, is it 29th, is it?
29th.
We're back to the 29th, but I may not be in tip-top shape because I'll have been to Copperface Jacks in the meantime.
Right, surely that won't have any impact, Barry. Yeah.
But I believe there is some video stuff going up on the site on
As you
Christmas
so
Eve,
correctly put it. Video stuff will be up on the site on the 24th, involving our summaries on the year that's been and our predictions for the year to come. That's up on Thursday, then. Look forward to that. We'll be back, not on Monday, because that's a bank holiday, but on Tuesday after the raft of games that there will be on Monday. So do join us for that, and we can look back on the year together, eh? In the meantime, send your posts in. Do have a happy Christmas, everyone, and lots of peace and love to you all. And many thanks for joining me today, Paul Doyle.
Christmas, James.
Jonathan Wilson, try a little harder.
Happy Christmas, James.
And Barry Glendening.
Bah, humbug.
And producer Ben, and indeed all our producers. We will see you after Christmas. Hope Santa brings you everything you could possibly desire.
Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian, in association with SportingBet.com.